listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Robin Whittaker.
And I'm Kylie Crabb. And today we're going to be speaking about readings and preaching for Easter Day. So to kick straight off, Robin, want to tell us a little bit about what you think about preaching on Easter Day and some of the things that might make it tricky?
Yeah, it's hard, I have to say. Yeah. When I was in a congregation, Christmas and Easter were always hard, right? Because in some ways we know the story as Christians, but we're trying to make it fresh. I think it's a Sunday where we might, if you're in a city church or a centre of a congregation in a rural town, you might have visitors or people who come very occasionally. So somehow the challenge is to preach a sermon that's accessible to newcomers and also interesting enough for people for whom it's literally their 74th Easter Sunday sermon.
Yes.
But I think the content is also challenging because when we talk about the resurrection, we're talking about something that is at its heart mysterious and miraculous. It defies logic. So I think we must resist any urge to explain or defend the resurrection. Like, it's not an apologetic exercise to like why you must believe this. I think somehow we need to try and capture, what it means.
Yeah.
Like how it affects the life of faith or how the
community. How it's good news.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So easier said than done, but I think one of the best Easter sermons I ever heard started with, it was by a priest who was also a poet, so it had beautiful poetic language I won't give justice to, but it started with like, somewhere in the dark of the night, the tomb rumbled, and it was all about how something happened, and we don't really know, but something happened, so when day dawned, it was a different day, and the world was changed kind of thing. So how we capture that mystery somehow. Mm. And we have lots of lectionary choices.
We do. There are loads of options for this day. So you have like a bit of a task looking through them all and picking them. We obviously can't speak about all of them, but today we're going to speak about the Isaiah 65 verses 17 to 25 reading, 1 Corinthians 15, 19 to 26, and John 20 verses 1 to 18. So we'll cover all of those things at some point in the next little while. But first of all, just a quick note then about the psalm.
Yeah, Psalm 118 I think is in itself already a liturgical psalm. If you read it, it's written as a kind of call and response. So let Israel say, God's steadfast love endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say, God's steadfast love endures forever. So it's already a liturgy. And I think I would encourage people to think about how we use this liturgically as a way of getting the congregation to kind of give voice to the good news. And of course, it's a psalm that ends with that famous line about, I will give thanks to you. This is the day that the Lord has made kind of thing. So it's celebratory and captures, I think, very much what the Isaiah reading is also doing, and of course the good news of John.
Yeah, so, bringing things together.
Yeah, exactly.
So Isaiah, a kind of picture, an idyllic prophetic picture that we get here in Isaiah. There are lots of things actually that stand out to me about it, but one of the things which I think does also go to the heart of what's tricky about preaching at Easter is about how you hold together the resurrection proclamation with the reality of people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I really notice in this reading is that at the very same time as affirming the transformation, and there's this whole transformation that is promised in this text, it's still naming things that are, I guess, kind of like classic theodicy kind of suffering examples, you know, so infants that live for just a few days and these kinds of things. So we have both of these things together, which, when we think bigger picture about what's going on in the Easter Day service, remembering, of course, that it is it is a continuation of the services over this whole period. So we're never proclaiming the resurrection without also acknowledging the crucifixion. In fact, it would kind of make no sense because what's the
what are you raised from?
Yeah, indeed, that's right. Yeah. But you know that I know that part of what's tricky is not just that people might only come at Easter and Christmas, but that people who come faithfully every week might not have been there since Palm Sunday either, and then they're there at Easter Day. So how we kind of make sure that we're not just talking about, I don't know, transformation that is just irrelevant to people's actual lives.
Yeah, it's not an empty hope that just looks like chipper optimism about the world, right?
Yeah,
in a way that can deny, you know, the reality. And, of course, on any given Easter Sunday, as there is on any Sunday when we preach the good news, there will be people in the midst of grief and various forms of suffering. So I think that's a great point, Kylie, about Isaiah, because I noticed the weeping and the sound of screams, and then it's also got these lines about building houses that they get to dwell in themselves. Yes. And I was like, that sounds a tad selfish. But, of course, it's you know, responding to a time of war where you built a house and someone invaded and kicked you out and lived in your space and you were displaced and homeless.
Yep.
So this idea of, you know, peace restored.
Yes.
And grief ending, like casting this vision of hope of a world where all the things one would hope for are actually.
Yeah. And a sense, I mean, I think also a just society, you know, that the people who do the labor also get to benefit from their labor. So you've got those who plant the seed will get to eat the food that comes from it, which of course maybe there's a bigger picture going on too, where we might also live in reciprocity with one another, but that some kind of base understanding that this idyllic community enables people equally to benefit from the labour that's going on.
Yeah. From what is produced. Yeah. And that, you know, it does end with, you know, there'll be no evil and no harm in this place, that, you know, those things don't have power anymore, which, of course, we're going to see picked up later on. A couple of things really stood out for me that I think are not always things I immediately associate with the Christian church, sadly, because they're everywhere in the Bible. But, you know, there's a call to rejoice and exult, like that there's a real sense of joy and celebration here, and it is at God doing a new thing.
Yeah.
And newness and change that is a result of newness is often experienced as threat, and yet here it is celebrated so much as anything new God is doing is only a cause for rejoicing, not for – so, I mean – there's a word of challenge in there, I think, to the church. And
I feel like too that there's something in there that is. It's also not like I don't know, like worshiping innovation and newness for the sake of, you know, like it's not about being faddish or something.
No,
because the newness that is described is stuff that is for the building up of the whole community. It's about transformation of suffering. You know, the newness is clearly of God. And so that's what the challenge is, to discern the thing to celebrate, that God is bringing new life into our old habits or our old ways, in ways that genuinely are about building up the whole community.
And it's deeply tied to tradition, because this holy mountain is a reference to Jerusalem and therefore to temple restored. So in a sense it is both a new thing and you know, renewal of the old thing that has been damaged and hurt. So, I read something by Old Testament scholar called Robert Alter. He thinks this vision of the new heaven and new earth, which when you spend as much time as I do with things like the Book of Revelation, immediately sound very apocalyptic and eschatological. Yeah. Yeah. But he points out that he reads this as actually poetic hyperbole. So he says it's not about some future far-off place, but actually in the prophetic tradition of the Hebrew Bible, this is imagining radical transformation of our communities as we are now in a way that kind of casts hope for, you know, this is something that can be not fully realized, but at least partially realized in our lifetimes. This is not about some magic future that we just wait for God to fix kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this actually relates to something that I think cuts across our other readings and is really interesting. I mean, I know that this is something that everybody will have heard said like 100 million times, but you know the phrase "already not yet," and I do wonder if, like, amongst quite a lot of our readings, there is an invitation to wonder about what does that actually mean. What are we actually talking about when we say something like that? And how does it, not just as a kind of like a concept that's trying to get around some kind of difficult issue in like the writings of the New Testament, but like how does that actually sound like good news to the people in our congregations or to anyone? So thinking about the 1 Corinthians 15 reading, and in the bit that it's worth reading through as well, if you're preparing to preach on this passage, just the kind of preceding verses, which will be familiar to you probably anyway, but the stuff about now if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say there's no resurrection of the dead? But then, you know, we have all of this stuff that is about that as though our faith is in vain. So if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. So this really grounding this sense there, but like what is it we're really saying in that kind of way? So then the passage that's set for this week, you know, it keeps going through this this stuff that's sort of almost, you know, this staged, you know, Jewish apocalyptic worldview about the end time, where we have the first fruits. So yes. Christ is the first fruits, and then we have this different kind of transformation of sort of almost in stages about what will happen now, and then what will happen at the end. So I guess what I'm wondering about is like, how do we make sense of any of that?
Yeah.
Does this Is there some kind of good news in the idea that something is fundamentally already changed, even if it is not actually, you know, even
not
if there
realized,
is a war in Ukraine and all of this like stuff that we're not remotely wanting to trivialize, but it does show that the not yet is still very much a part of our experience, right?
It is, and there's no doubt for Paul, I think, that he thinks the cosmos has changed as a result. Like something has fundamentally shifted in the kind of power dynamics of the world, the universe. But what that means for any of us, right? Because obviously Christians weren't so naive as to think that like suffering and sin and death and all those things magically vanished. Yeah. I mean, I suspect the way we need to answer that, I mean, answer in inverted commas.
Respond to,
thank you. Yeah. In our sermons is maybe to personalize it. Like, you know, what difference does that make to our own lives in terms of offering hope that there is at least a possibly different future?
Yeah.
That the future could look different to the past?
Yeah.
Hope that no matter how awful life is, that, you know, and this is taking us into the John reading, so I'll resist going too far, but, you know, that Christ has gone away, gone ahead of us to prepare rooms in his Father's house, kind of, you know, hope that somehow in this shared resurrection that Christ exemplifies and kind of embodies a promise to all of us. I mean, that I was quite struck by the language in 1 Corinthians 15. So, you know, in verse 22, as all die in Adam, so all will be made alive in Christ. It's not only resurrection of the faithful, it's the resurrection of humanity. It's not to say there aren't hints of judgment in Paul's theology of what then happens, but actually all are raised, and this possibility that even death is not the final end, I think, for anyone who's lost a loved one is enormously comforting.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that there is something too about the, you know, like there across our Easter liturgy, we're thinking about, you know, in Good Friday, we are thinking really profoundly and deeply about God's solidarity with those who suffer, you know, like the absolute depths of everything that that the world has to throw at humans, God is with us in that. And I know and have heard from people before about, like, you know, that sometimes in their experience that like that is as far as you can go to say, like, this is things are terrible, and what we can say is God is with us in that, in Christ. And yet Easter Day like pushes us past that to say that it's not just about God being with us in suffering. It actually is also about the promise of the transformation of that suffering, and that it can be like not remotely simplistically. I don't mean that at all, but that there can also be some way, if this is the first fruits of a future promise, there actually is some, perhaps not always tangible to us, but in moments we might glimpse it, this sense of the future coming forward into our lives, of this already, something about the confidence in these texts of that future resurrection, of something that's already effected through Jesus' resurrection, that does change our experience in the present, because we have this bigger picture of the way the world will be transformed that can make us able to endure now. But as I said, not simplistically just put up with horrible things, but when we are in the depths of that knowing,
this promise. And look, I don't know how to particularly do this well, but it seems to me this is where poetic metaphors and things do help. You know, it is the hint of the sunrise that pierces a dark night, and it's you know, all of those images that are about, you know, not, as you say, not negating or minimalizing or trivializing any kind of real suffering or the difficulty of life, but actually having that glimpse that kind of something different might be over the horizon, and wherever that horizon is. But I think what you're saying sparks in me too, and an observation of what Paul's doing here is, I mean, Paul's kind of answering a question which is like, what difference does this make, right? Because he's refuting this, if you say the resurrection only makes a difference to our life here and now, you're pitiable, like you've missed the point. And, you know, so for Paul, it is all about what this means and what difference it makes to the way we live. He's not doing what I think we're so tempted to do in a post-Enlightenment world, which is to try and engage the scientific question of, or you know, what is resurrection? Is it resuscitation? Is it like, I just think we need, like, you know, we do this with the virgin birth and other things, like, could it actually be real?
Yeah.
Paul's not asking for him, this is real.
Yes.
And the real thing is, what does the real question is, what does it mean?
Yes, that's right. And it is this kind of thing about the Adam and Christ, you know, all of this stuff, it's what we call apocalyptic Paul, right? It's like the whole, the very fabric of the universe is different now. And while we might and do continue to experience these other things, there is something fundamental that gives us hope that is different. I guess the other thing I'd notice about this passage is that there's also this kind of like, I mean, to me, it sort of does also sound quite violent kind of imagery. So talking about Christ reigning until he's put his enemies under his feet. Mm. The last enemy destroyed is death. So we've got this invitation to think about that a bit more metaphorically.
Yep.
And then, you know, God has put all things in subjection under his, Christ's feet. So I think, I mean, I just flagged that language as stuff to wonder about, to think about the really hard stuff in people's lives that does actually feel like enemies. Not other people, not thinking in those kinds of terms, but actually the kind of battles that we face
that might defeat us.
And that feel like they're going to defeat us. And the idea that an enemy like death, or an enemy like self-doubt, or other kinds of oppression, or, you know, all sorts of things that are the things that people get up each day and live under the shadow of, that those things might be being subjected and under the feet of Christ could be actually really liberating.
If you'd like to know more about By the Well or any of our hosts, please visit bythewell.com.au. So we might move on to the Gospel reading, which is John 20, 1-18, and continues next week for those of you doing John this week. Kylie, it struck me that one of the other themes that I think we see across all of these readings today is we've got an evoking of
the Genesis creation stories in different kinds of ways. So Paul evokes Adam and that story of, you know, losing immortality in the garden when he was cast out. John will also invoke a Garden of Eden and has done in the Johannine Passion. Jesus uniquely sort of prays in the garden and is arrested in the garden, and we're going to see garden stuff continue in the resurrection scene. And, of course, Isaiah talks about a new heaven and a new earth as well. So there's something in resurrection that seems to evoke or take us back to creation and God's original purpose. Do you what do you make anything of that, or what else do you notice in John that we might want to pick up?
Yeah, yeah. No, well, I mean, I think that stuff is really interesting to wonder about. Noticing, of course, that we also have this stuff about new heavens and new earth. So we get, like, you know, all of the there are other parts of the New Testament that will talk about heavenly cities and New Jerusalems and stuff. So you get like cities and gardens. You get like a totally restored creation. There might be ways of wondering about what this has to tell us about the natural world and Christians' relationship with the natural world and hope in and the climate crisis and all sorts of things. I would wonder about in that. The other thing that really I mean, strikes me about all of the narratives that are by the empty tomb in our different gospels, but you know we get it here, is the role of Mary. Here it's just Mary, who's there first, and who also has this encounter with Jesus, who she initially mistakes for being the gardener. But I mean, and there are like, obviously, a lot of things that we can and will say about that. But one of the things that it brought to mind for me actually is a recent book by two biblical scholars, Helen Bond and Joan Taylor, which is called Women Remembered, Jesus's Female Disciples. And they have a nice chapter within that about Mary Magdalene, which might be worth wondering about. It's interesting that Christian tradition remembers Mary as the first witness to the resurrection in all these different sources. And in fact, there's an early Christian writer, Origen, who in his writing that is refuting someone called Celsus, he's responding to a criticism that one of the problems with Christianity is that it's all based on the witness of this woman who he describes as a delirious woman as a way of, you know, like putting down Christianity. Yeah. And we might, you know, like use this as an opportunity to wonder about, like, what does it mean that we actually are practicing a faith that is based on the initial witness of women?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that's an interesting invitation for us.
Yeah, it really is. Let's explore that a bit more. I mean, it is striking that John has Mary Magdalene by herself.
Yes.
Right? All the other Gospels have a kind of a little group of women. And we don't have, I'm just checking, we don't have the emphasis here on the spices and the herbs and stuff, right? She's
just
come to the tomb.
Yep.
It's in a garden in John, as we said, and that might explain why she thinks he's the gardener.
Yes, exactly.
It could also, again, be symbolic for God as the gardener of the world or something, but I think
It
can also just work as why she thinks he's a gardener.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think there's a nice continuity. You know, like people remember other bits of John where people, a character will interpret something that Jesus says or does kind of literally, and then there's some kind of pun or play or something where then there's a spiritual level of understanding that they get to. So Nicodemus with his being born again and being born from above, this nice little pun, which is more obvious in the Greek, but you know, there's this thing there. The woman by the well in chapter 4 where she thinks of literal water that Jesus is going to get her.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's talking about living water. So, you know, we have this thing here, and here we have like the gardener, and it's not the gardener. It's actually Jesus, or the true gardener, we might wonder.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, and so she's not the, I mean, she sees the stone removed and runs and tells the men, and we can come back to them. But so it's not that she witnesses the empty tomb firstness, or I mean, she's, doesn't go in, but that she's the first to see the risen Jesus in John's narrative, which is So powerful. But before we get there, do we want to say anything about this little foot race? Between
oh, yeah, yeah. And yes. Some of the stuff, I mean, people might know this, right, this kind of shadowy character in the fourth gospel, the beloved disciple, the one whom Jesus loves. And he's always kind of doing a bit better than everybody else. So that people often assume that this is somehow connected to the author or the community behind the gospel, that they're trying to say, well, our local apostle is better than yours. So we get this funny thing where there's this sort of competitive running with the beloved disciple and Peter, and Peter gets there, but then the beloved disciple comes up behind and then comes into the tomb and outruns Peter. And then he kind of, this beloved disciple, sort of already just puts two and two together and like perfectly understands, according to the implication of the narrative, what's been going on. And he then just scoots off and goes to proclaim things elsewhere or move on.
Yeah.
And then we cut back to this scene with Mary, who's crying, who has obviously not understood. And so on the one hand, you know, this is sometimes taken as being part of the rhetorical response, a bit like this memory that we get in Origen responding to Celsus about the idea that the women were untrustworthy witnesses, or Mary is an untrustworthy witness. So we need to, like, you know, get someone else in there first who can really understand what's going on.
A couple of men to testify so that's we can believe
right.
them. Yep.
Yeah, that's right. The woman needs to find it first, but then the guys need to say it and then it's real, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But actually I think that there is something, I mean, even if there is some kind of weird rhetoric going on behind that, there's actually something in terms of preaching on this text, some good news, I feel, in this thing that actually maybe Mary doesn't go straight in and put two and two together and stuff like that. She's not being cocky about it. She's heartbroken and she's outside the tomb, and then in fact she has this profound experience where she interacts with the risen Jesus. And I think it's actually a little bit similar maybe to the experience that Thomas has, where he just, you know, later in the chapter, where he's gone from not believing and not just being like, you know, not just saying, oh, I'll just go along with what you say. Like, he's really uncertain and expresses his uncertainty, and then comes to make the most profound confession of faith in the gospel. So there is, I feel like there is something in here that is like good news to the people who don't, like, just get on board straight away, or who are, you know, whose doubts are not immediately allayed, or you know, maybe there are other disciples out there that we can see from a distance and blithely assume that it's easy for them to believe. Those people may or may not actually exist, but it seems from the outside like it's easy for them to believe stuff, and they've just
embraced it all and
and headed back to the group and said, this is really true and blah, blah. And maybe it doesn't feel like that to all of us. Well, here is good news in two different parts of chapter 20 of John's gospel, that Jesus comes to those people, the people who were still standing crying outside the tomb, and brings a profound experience. And in fact, in this way, Mary becomes the first witness to the risen Jesus.
To actually see, and one scholar I read talked about in the you know, in verse 16, when she, the moment of recognition is when Jesus says her name, Mary.
Yes.
So, I mean, that evokes, again, we get all these themes from earlier in the gospel that are drawn together here. So, you know, it takes us back to, what is it, John 10. My sheep know my voice, I call them by name, kind of, you know. But she turns to him and says, Rabuni, which is maybe in Hebrew or Aramaic, like my teacher or the teacher. But that's something a disciple says, right? She doesn't call him Lord and God like Thomas will later, but my teacher, that puts her in the posture of a disciple in the ancient world. And so this commentator I was reading talked about, you know, this is Mary's call to discipleship as well as witness. And it's not to say she hasn't been a disciple of sorts, but it's kind of affirmation of that. And like you say, she's maybe come to this in a couple of steps.
Yeah.
And yet will be this vital character in early Christianity, and is sent to immediately tell. So there's something here about witnessing, like she sees, she responds, and then she's immediately sent to go tell my brothers.
Yeah.
Say to them.
You know, and I do love that, like getting back to this thing about if there is some memory in here of some kind of apologetic about the women being unreliable witnesses or whatever. Like, actually, here's an early Christian text who maybe includes something like that, but then also confronts it and just sends her off as the first witness, you know. So it's also challenging that assumption as well.
Yeah, and I love that her testimony is personal, and this could again be a preaching theme. I have seen is what she says. I have seen the Lord. And again, in John's gospel, the first disciples are called back in chapter 1 with come and see.
Yes.
The Samaritan woman at the well goes and tells the town, come and see this man who told me, you know, everything about myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, how can we capture that come and see? Like, that's the response to the resurrection. We're not explaining it, but we're inviting people to come and see with us what, you know, what this text does.
Yeah, great. And come and see, and maybe as we live it, rather than explain it, maybe it really does change how things unfold for us. Yeah. Mm.
Well, happy Easter, Kylie.
You too. Thanks, Robin.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.